between. The largest telescope in the world, a mile in circumference, is no longer in the USA. It's in the Guizhou province of China. So when aliens say hi, the first humans to receive their signal will be Chinese astrophysicists. The first spectrograph. Bunsen and Kirchhoff built the first spectrograph, an instrument for measuring spectra, from a couple of old surveyor's telescopes, a prism, and, believe it or not, a cigar box. So, how does this relate to astrophysics and the ways we have come to know what we now know? It doesn't matter how far away the source of light is, its signature spectrum is always the same. It can be at the other end of a laboratory bench, or in a galaxy billions of light years away. Once the light is emitted, it carries a distinct spectrum, containing multiple fingerprints that identify the nature of the source. This fact empowers astrophysicists to identify the chemical content of stars and exoplanets, allowing us to pay a little less attention to where is it, and more attention to what is it.
Knowledge from above the atmosphere. We have seen that the atmosphere is transparent to radio waves and visible light, but the visible light window isn't perfect. The turbulent movement of air as light passes through it blurs the image we receive on the ground and, incidentally, also makes stars twinkle. So don't ever wish an astrophysicist a night of twinkling stars. How to transcend these limitations? One obvious solution is to put our receivers above the atmosphere rather than on the ground below it. Another strategy, appropriate only for objects you can get to, is to send a spacecraft to the source of the radiation and get a close-up view. At the moment, that works for places within the solar system. Beyond that, we've got work to do. In low Earth orbit. Of all the destinations in the solar system, the easiest place to send a satellite is into Earth orbit. It requires less energy to put a satellite into orbit than to send it anywhere else. Also, if the altitude is in range of our crewed vehicles, then astronauts can visit to make repairs and install updates, allowing the observatory in question to function for a long time, as was done with the Hubble Space Telescope. Earth orbits are also useful for Global Positioning System, GPS, satellites, as well as satellites designed to monitor Earth systems, including sea level and temperature. At Lagrange points. Named for the Italian mathematician Joseph Louis Lagrange, Lagrange points are locations in space where all forces of motion and gravity are in balance between two cosmic objects, Earth and the Sun, or Earth and the Moon, for example. Anything placed there will have no tendency to fall in one direction or another. Newton's first law of motion tells us that any object sent into space will either continue moving in the direction we sent it, or surrender to the gravity of another object. At Lagrange points, an object rests between an equal push and pull of all forces. They are veritable parking spots for space hardware. Any two-body system has five Lagrange points. The one labeled L1, located between Earth and the Sun, provides NASA's and the European Space Agency's solar telescope an uninterrupted view of the Sun. L2, located on the far side of the Earth-Sun system, allows an uninterrupted view of deep space and is the future location of the James Webb Space Telescope.
1 million. The number of miles from Earth where we find Lagrange points L1 and L2.
Via spacecraft. We have devised many ways to gain knowledge from here on Earth, but the best way to get to know a celestial object is to visit it. Humans have launched a flotilla of spacecraft over the past decades to explore the rest of the solar system. By now, spacecraft have flown by every planet in our system, orbited a few, and investigated a number of asteroids and comets. Some significant milestones. The twin Voyager spacecrafts, launched in 1977, were the first artificial objects to leave the solar system. Voyager 1 in 2012 and Voyager 2 in 2018. The Galileo spacecraft, launched in 1989, discovered the subsurface oceans of Europa while orbiting Jupiter from 1995 to 2003, thereafter plunging to its death in Jupiter's atmosphere. The New Horizons spacecraft, launched in 2006, flew by Pluto in 2015, as well as the Kuiper Belt object, 486958 Arrokoth, in 2019, as it continues to exit the solar system. The Cassini spacecraft, launched in 1997, arrived at Saturn in 2004. It remained in orbit there for 13 years, providing stunning images and unprecedented data on the planet, its ring system, and its moons. Cassini further unveiled worlds like icy Enceladus, where, as on Jupiter's Europa, extraterrestrial life may thrive in subsurface oceans. Mimicking the Galileo spacecraft, in 2017, Cassini made its final death dive through Saturn's atmosphere, ending its mission.
A tweet. Farewell, Cassini. How far you've come. On this eve in fiery death, Saturn and you are one. VIP. Vaporize in peace. 2004 to 2017.
Opening new windows on the universe. Electromagnetic waves aren't the only source of information from the heavens. Other kinds of waves and an entire rogues gallery of particles also reach Earth. Each time we learn how to detect and understand these visitors, we open a new window on the universe. Two fresh windows recently opened: neutrinos and gravitational waves. And more await our clever technologies to open them, including dark energy and dark matter. Neutrinos. The neutrino, meaning little neutral one, has no electrical charge and almost no mass. A fundamental particle, neutrinos are copiously produced in nuclear reactions and hardly ever interact with matter. As you read this, 100 billion of them pass through every square centimeter of your body every second, but only a few will ever jostle even one of your atoms in your lifetime. The only way to detect neutrinos, then, is to force-feed them lots of atoms with which to interact. This is the idea behind Ice Cube, a giant neutrino detector located at the South Pole. Hot water bores holes into the ice, into which cables carrying light detectors are lowered. Then the water freezes around them. When neutrinos jostle an atom in the ice, these detectors see a characteristic flash of light. By this clever technique, Ice Cube transforms an entire cubic kilometer of Antarctic ice into a dedicated neutrino detector. Even more amazing, some of the neutrinos Ice Cube detected will have hit the Earth at the North Pole and traveled all the way through the planet without interacting with a single atom before they enter the cubic kilometer of ice at the South Pole. Gravitational waves. The general theory of relativity predicts that if massive objects are accelerated, they will emit a wave in the space-time continuum. Picture them as outgoing ripples of water on a smooth pond. These waves are very weak, but they have a characteristic influence on the material objects they encounter. In a comically exaggerated image, if we start with a basketball, then a gravitational wave will squish it into a football shape and then back to a basketball as it passes through. In reality, these distortions are tiny, smaller than the diameter of particles within the nucleus of an atom. Enter LIGO, Laser Interferometer Gravitational Wave Observatory, a research facility equipped with two arms in the shape of an L, each 4 kilometers long. A laser shoots light down each arm to a mirror, which reflects it back. If a gravitational wave washes over it, the path length will briefly change, shifting the mirrors relative to each other. On September 14, 2015, LIGO recorded the first measurement ever of a gravitational wave, a century after Einstein predicted them. The wave, generated by the collision of two black holes with masses 36 and 29 times the mass of the Sun, emanated from a long time ago in a galaxy far, far away, about 1.5 billion light years from Earth. Since then, other countries have built gravitational wave detectors, developing what will ultimately become a global network.
Duplicating efforts. There are actually two detectors in the original LIGO array, one in Louisiana and one in Washington State. This two-facility system was built to avoid accidental events or intentional pranks masquerading as gravitational waves at one location or the other.
Observatories today. Hundreds of astronomical observatories are scattered over Earth's surface, and we have dozens more in space, each one with its own role in contributing to our knowledge. What follows are some of the most spectacular of these windows to the cosmos. Observatories on the ground. The main problem with observatories on the ground is the imperfect, fuzzy view they offer through our atmosphere and out into the cosmos. Air turbulence and the presence of disruptive gases, such as water vapor, can distort images. To minimize this problem, the world's leading observatories are typically located at high altitude, above most of the weather that confounds observations. The two highest. Mauna Kea Observatories. Located more than 14,000 feet, 4,200 meters, above sea level on the Big Island of Hawaii, the Mauna Kea Observatories house more than a dozen different telescopes. The site sees all of the northern and most of the southern sky and is located in the middle of the Pacific Ocean, offering a stable atmosphere and a minimum of twinkling. Assorted detectors mounted on these telescopes monitor electromagnetic radiation from infrared to visible light as well as microwave radiation. Atacama Observatories. Other than parts of Antarctica, the Atacama Desert in Chile is the driest spot on the planet. Some areas have no recorded rainfall ever. Add to this an elevation above 15,000 feet, 4,570 meters, and we've got one of the choicest spots in the southern hemisphere to locate a telescope. One important installation is the Atacama Large Millimeter Submillimeter Array, ALMA. Radio telescopes that, because of their elevation, capture microwaves before they are absorbed by water vapor in the lower atmosphere. Observatories in space. The Hubble Space Telescope, launched in 1990, remains the crown jewel of space observatories and is arguably the most productive telescope ever built. In fact, based on the sheer number of research papers and international collaborators engaged, Hubble may be the most productive scientific instrument of any kind ever. Unfortunately, Hubble now nears the end of its productive life, and NASA has no further plans for service missions. The Hubble is one of several great observatories in NASA's portfolio. The others are the Compton Gamma Ray Observatory, the Chandra X-ray Observatory, and the Spitzer Infrared Space Telescope. The observatories are named for scientists Arthur Compton, Subramanian Chandrasekhar, and Lyman Spitzer. Together with the ground-based observatories already described, they provide astrophysicists with information from every known part of the electromagnetic spectrum. In addition, a wide variety of probes and specialized observatories operate in deep space. More than 40 NASA missions are active today, and other countries have followed. Recently, China landed a probe on the far side of the moon, and the European Space Agency, ESA, launched a state-of-the-science observatory to study exoplanets. Coming attractions. At any moment, dozens of scientific proposals are afloat, each with an innovative idea that aims to solve an important problem. Unfortunately, they cannot all be funded, but here are a few that have run the gauntlet of peer review, funding, and development, and will soon be in operation. And another that still has a way to go. James Webb Space Telescope. Designed as the successor to the Hubble Space Telescope, the James Webb Space Telescope's 21-foot, 6.5-meter mirror, significantly larger than the Hubble's, is constructed from 18 interlocking hexagonal segments made of gold-coated beryllium. It will observe wavelengths from visible light into the mid-infrared. Its detection abilities will be unmatched for a spaceborne telescope, with a primary goal to detect objects with extremely large redshifts, the oldest objects in the universe. These are nascent galaxies, with light that began in the blue part of the spectrum, but got redshifted by the expanding universe as it traveled, all the way to the infrared by the time it reaches us. After launch, the James Webb Telescope will park itself at the Earth-Sun L2 Lagrange point, shadowed from the sun by a large shield, and unfurl its mirror segments, which were cleverly folded for the journey there. Because this point is a million miles from Earth, there is no chance that astronauts can make repairs and upgrades as they do for the Hubble, so the James Webb Space Telescope absolutely must work on the first and only attempt at deployment. Extremely Large Telescope. This aptly named instrument is funded by the European Space Agency and is under construction in the Atacama Desert of Chile. Its primary mirror is a staggering 130 feet, 40 meters across. For comparison, the diameter of the largest visible light telescope built in the 20th century was one-fourth that diameter. In addition to its size, the Extremely Large Telescope, ELT, will use a technology called adaptive optics to produce sharp images more than 10 times as detailed as Hubble. To accomplish this, the various segments of the mirror will be deformed in real time to compensate for changes in the atmosphere. This will allow the ELT to examine and obtain images of exoplanets, and perhaps to detect water and organic compounds in protoplanetary disks that will someday evolve into planetary systems. Laser Interferometer Space Antenna. This system represents the next step in detecting gravitational waves, also funded by the European Space Agency. The Laser Interferometer Space Antenna, LISA, will consist of three free-flying satellites located at the corners of an equilateral triangle whose sides are more than six times longer than the distance between Earth and the Moon. The triangle will orbit the Sun but trail Earth by roughly 30 million miles, 50 million kilometers. Like its Earth-bound predecessor, LIGO, though much more sensitive, LISA is designed to detect the ripples in space-time associated with gravitational waves, in this case by tracking the relative positions of test masses located in each of the three satellites. LISA represents the next step in opening the gravitational window into the heavens. Chapter 3. How did the universe get to be this way? The Big Bang. The Atomic Universe. Building the Familiar Universe. The Nebular Hypothesis. The Frost Line. Cosmic Billiards. Planetary Migration. The Outer Reaches. 3. Edwin Hubble didn't just establish the existence of galaxies. He also discovered the universe's most salient feature. It is expanding. Hubble used the standard Candle method, developed by Henrietta Leavitt, to determine the distance to nearby galaxies, and then created a whole new rung on the distance ladder by combining these measurements with a telltale feature of distant galaxies, that the wavelengths of light emitted by atoms and molecules in those galaxies are measurably longer than they would be when measured in the laboratory. We call this phenomenon redshift, because red light has the longest wavelength of all the colors visible to the human eye. It was a vital discovery that would continually serve our quest to learn about how the universe got to be the way it is today. Here's a profound fact of physics. Objects that exhibit redshifts are moving away from you, and the bigger the shift, the faster they are moving. When Hubble sorted the redshifts of galaxies by distance, a mind-blowing fact sprung forth. The farther away a galaxy is, the faster it is moving away from us. This is known as Hubble's law and can be written in equation form as V equals HD, where V is the velocity of the galaxy, D is the distance to it, and H is a number known as Hubble's constant. In other words, the universe is expanding. Rather than think of galaxies moving outward like a fireworks display, instead, picture raisins scattered throughout rising bread dough. Now, imagine hanging out on one of those raisins. You would see all the other raisins moving away from you, and the farther away from you another raisin was, the faster it would be moving, simply because more expanding bread dough exists between you and it. The raisins aren't moving through the dough, but rather they are carried along by the expansion of the dough itself. One final point about our bread dough universe. Any raisin you choose to stand on offers the same view as every other raisin. You will perceive your own raisin as stationary, while all other raisins appear to be moving away from you. Every raisin sees itself as the center of an expanding dough universe. In the accidentally prescient words of the medieval philosopher Nicholas of Cusa, "The universe has its center everywhere and its edge nowhere." The model of our expanding and cooling universe beginning at a specific time in the past, when all other matter and energy were in the same place at the same time, is called the Big Bang, and it contains the core ideas of how the universe evolved into what we know it to be today. And it turns out that modern analysis of the expansion allows us to estimate the age of the universe with exquisite accuracy. The Big Bang. Generally, when materials are compressed, their temperature rises. If you have ever inflated a bicycle tire using a hand pump, you may have noticed the valve warms up as your actions continue, a direct result of compressing the air within the pump cylinder. The universe operates similarly. If you imagine running the film of the Hubble expansion backward, the universe would get hotter as we got smaller. Imagine that you have confined steam at a high temperature and pressure, like inside a rice cooker. What happens when you release the pressure? The steam expands and cools. It will, in fact, keep cooling until its temperature reaches 212 degrees Fahrenheit, 100 degrees Celsius. At this moment, an important event happens. The steam condenses into water droplets. If the cooling continues down to 32 degrees Fahrenheit, 0 degrees Celsius, the water freezes into ice. These structural transformations are called phase changes. The history of the universe is like the story of the steam, except with 6 phase changes instead of 2. The first 4 of these happened before the universe was a second old. We'll come back to them after we've learned a little more about what matter is made of. For the moment, let's take up the story of the expanding universe at an age of about 1 minute. At this time, the universe is a swarm of elementary particles, protons, neutrons, and electrons, and photons of light, all moving and colliding at high energy. If a proton and a neutron combine to form a simple atomic nucleus, the next collision it encounters will be violent enough to tear them apart. Not until the universe turns about 3 minutes old, do things cool down enough for protons and neutrons to bond into a stable nucleus that survives subsequent collisions. This is a phase transition. These first collisions produce simple nuclei, composed of a single proton and a single neutron. In subsequent collisions, nuclei with more protons form. 2 protons merge to create the helium atom, and just a few 3-proton nuclei form the lithium atom. But after about 45 seconds of this, a new effect emerges to shut down the production of nuclei. The Hubble expansion carries the particles far enough apart so that no more collisions occur and no more nuclei are made. So here's one big part of how the universe got the way it is. The universe births itself with nuclei of hydrogen, helium, and trace amounts of lithium. Heavier elements, including the carbon in your tissues and the iron in your blood, are forged later in the guts of stars.
The Doppler effect. 19th century Austrian physicist Christian Doppler discovered his celebrated principle by studying the changing pitch of a train whistle as the train moves by. If the source of a wave, be it light or sound, is in motion, different observers will perceive that wave differently, depending on whether the source is moving toward or away from them. If the source of a sound wave moves toward you, the distance between the crests of the wave, the wavelength, will be shorter than if the source remains stationary, giving you a higher pitch. And if the source moves away from you, the wavelength will be longer, generating a lower pitch. For light waves, a receding source produces waves that have longer, redder wavelengths. You may have had more experience with the Doppler effect than you thought. You just need to pay attention. Next time a speeding ambulance approaches and then recedes from you, notice the change in pitch of its siren, becoming higher as it approaches, then dropping down lower as it moves away. A tweet. A reminder that in a baseball game, you cannot blame an umpire's enlarged strike zone on the expanding universe.
The atomic universe. When do atoms become players in this drama of the universe becoming what it is? The several-minute-old universe we just left is a hot, expanding gas of nuclei rattling around with free electrons in a soup of electromagnetic radiation. This fourth state of matter is called plasma, which forms whenever electrons are torn from atoms in a gas. This typically occurs at high temperatures. Our sun, for example, which counts as a high-temperature place, is composed entirely of plasma. Atoms form when these free electrons hook themselves onto a willing nucleus. But not until the universe was 380,000 years old did the temperature drop enough for freshly formed atoms to remain stable, enduring all subsequent collisions. During this early period, then, before the temperature fell and atoms endured, the universe consisted of particles with net electric charge, negative electrons, and positive nuclei. The radiation that shared the early universe with the plasma interacted violently with the charged particles. If a clump of plasma tried to come together under the influence of gravity, the radiation blew the clumps of matter apart. Think of the radiation as a bunch of cannonballs careening around the plasma, blasting away at these concentrations. And this, of course, meant that galaxies and stars, themselves clumps of matter, couldn't form. That's why the eventual formation of atoms is so important. Healthy atoms don't have a net electrical charge. All the protons in the nucleus balance the electrons outside it. This property inoculated the atoms against the violent interaction with radiation. The conversion of the charged plasma into a collection of neutral atoms, then, had two effects. Galaxies and stars began to form, and radiation, freed from its condemnation to ricochet among charged particles, escaped. The universe became transparent. You can experience a similar phenomenon the next time you prepare a glass of iced tea. Watch what happens as you add sugar. At first, the iced tea looks cloudy. Sugar in large clumps scatters light, so none of it comes straight through. As the sugar dissolves into electrically neutral molecules, the cloudiness dissipates and the fluid becomes clear and transparent again. In the same way, once the particles of the plasma became full-blooded atoms, the radiation no longer prevented the accumulation of material under the influence of gravity. The familiar modern universe was being born, and the radiation flew off to become what today we measure as the cosmic microwave background.
The six phase changes. Nearly all matter on Earth exists in three states: solid, liquid, and gas. Add or subtract enough energy to a material, and it will undergo a phase change from one state to another. Four transitions are familiar. The remaining two, not so much. Melting, solid to liquid. Freezing, liquid to solid. Vaporization, liquid to gas. Condensation, gas to liquid. Sublimation, solid to gas. Deposition, gas to solid. Sublimation occurs when the air pressure above a solid is too low to sustain the liquid state of that substance. Everyday air pressure works well to sustain liquid water, but it fails for liquid carbon dioxide. So-called dry ice, for example, which is solid carbon dioxide, goes straight to gaseous carbon dioxide at room temperature and ordinary atmospheric pressure. Deposition happens when a gas loses energy so quickly it skips the condensation stage and forms a solid. A mild example of this is a frosted forest floor on a chilly winter morning, after water vapor in the air crystallizes into frost on the ground vegetation. A tweet. Don't know if it's good or bad that a Google search on Big Bang Theory list the sitcom before the origin of the universe. Tearing atoms. In the early universe, atoms could not withstand the force of their own collisions and tore apart. It doesn't actually take all that much energy to tear electrons from their atoms. Happens all the time inside all neon signs, every time you turn on a fluorescent bulb, and every time you run around on a carpet in just socks and then touch someone's nose.
Building the familiar universe. How did the universe transform from an expanding collection of atoms into our cozy world of galaxies, stars, and planets? This question bothered cosmologists for a long time. People trying to answer this question were inevitably confronted and confounded by an intractable problem. Because radiation decimated charged particles, matter could not begin to clump and form galaxies until neutral atoms showed up and the universe became transparent. By that time, however, the Hubble expansion had spread matter so thin that even the mutual attraction of all the known sources of gravity wouldn't succeed in attracting enough material to make a galaxy. So what happened? The solution came from a mysterious, unexpected source, something we call dark matter. In the 1930s, the Swiss-American astrophysicist Fritz Zwicky first identified this stuff as part of a cluster of galaxies whose constituent members were moving much faster than their visible sources of gravity could possibly sustain. Thus was born the dark matter problem in the universe. In 1970, American astrophysicist Vera Rubin rediscovered evidence for dark matter during observations of stellar orbits within galaxies themselves. As the term implies, dark matter does not interact with light, nor does it interact with any other kind of electromagnetic radiation. It does, however, exert a gravitational force. In fact, we have come to understand that dark matter is the source of 85% of all gravity observed in the universe, thereby solving the clumping problem. Recall that matter couldn't clump into galaxies before neutrally charged atoms formed, because radiation in the plasma blows concentrations of charged matter apart as soon as they start to form. Dark matter, however, invisible and impervious to the destructive radiation, accumulated before the universe became transparent. Thus, when atoms formed, they found themselves in wombs of dark matter, within which gravitational attraction could begin and persist. Imagine you have a bag of marbles, and you begin dumping all those marbles onto a tabletop modeled with deeply drilled holes. The marbles fall effortlessly into these indentations, forming clumps around the holes. The table is the universe, the marbles are ordinary matter, and the holes are the effects of dark energy. All the ordinary matter had to do was fall into the gravitational holes that dark matter had already carved out. Although we still haven't a clue what dark matter is, the formal term for this state of ignorance is clueless, we can measure dark matter's direct gravitational influence on ordinary matter and hypothesize that it primed the early universe for matter to gather and become galaxies, ready to form stars, planets, and people, the universe we know today. From atoms to stars. Gravity is a beast, never ceasing, ever enduring, pulling everything together. Stars feel it constantly. At each stage in a star's life, a new strategy deploys that staves off the relentless pull of gravity. The first step in this journey begins with thermonuclear fusion, a foundational process that helped shape the universe as we know it today. When we last saw our universe, ordinary matter had collected into galaxy-sized clouds in gravitational nesting grounds created by dark matter. Within those clouds, matter concentrated more in some places than in others. In other words, galaxies can get lumpy. The extra gravitational force exerted within each lump attracts in the surrounding matter, enlarging the lump ever further. As the lump grows, its gravitational force pulls in even more matter, strengthening the gravitational force further still, and on and on. The simple effect of gravity, then, turns gigantic clouds of scattered atoms and molecules into collections of smaller, more compact objects that eventually become stars and planets. As gravity does its thing, the gaseous matter collapses and heats up in response. Hot, fast-moving atoms now collide with enough energy to tear off their electrons, turning the gas of the protostar back into a plasma. As the contraction continues, the temperature at the center keeps rising, reaching millions of degrees. Now, something new happens. Protons, all positively charged, normally repel one another by the electric force. But at these high temperatures, they move fast enough to overcome this repulsion and fuse to become larger nuclei. Behold, thermonuclear fusion, which generates stupendous quantities of energy. The mass of the larger nuclei is slightly less than the sum of the smaller nuclei that compose them. That mass gap, as prescribed by Einstein's famous equation, E equals mc squared, liberates the energy that sustains the star. That energy percolates outward with a pressure that, when combined with the pressure within the hot plasma itself, balances the force of gravity and stops the contraction. When this first wave of energy reaches the surface, a star is born. Modern cosmology suggests that the first stars began to shine when the universe was about 300 million years old. Eventually, when a star's nuclear fuel runs out, other lines of defense are employed. Depending on its total mass, the star can end its life as a white dwarf, a cooling ember about the size of Earth, or a dense neutron star, the end product of a supernova explosion, a mere 10 miles, 17 kilometers across. In a supernova, atoms created by fusion return to space, ready, willing, and able to seed future stellar systems. The most massive of stars end up as black holes, the ultimate triumph of gravity.
A tweet. Four mysteries of the universe that continue to elude top researchers. 1. What is the origin of life? 2. What is the nature of dark matter? 3. What preceded the Big Bang? 4. What does the refrigerator light do after you close the door? 600 million tons. The sun converts this much hydrogen into helium every second. Stellar lifetimes. You might think that massive stars, because they have more hydrogen fuel, would last longer than smaller stars. Actually, the opposite is true. Because large stars have to work harder to counteract the greater gravitational force, they consume their hydrogen reserve much faster than smaller stars. A high-mass star may live only tens of millions of years, whereas the lowest mass stars will keep shining for trillions of years.
The Nebular Hypothesis. Pierre Simon Marquis de Laplace was a mathematician, French of course, whose name is familiar to every scientist and engineer. He rose to fame in France, where Napoleon, a close connection, appointed him as Minister of the Interior. That appointment lasted only 6 weeks, by which time Napoleon realized Laplace was a worse-than-average administrator and sent him back to the academy. But the French government's loss was astronomy's gain, because Laplace figured out that solar systems like ours arise from the gravitational collapse of a large cloud of interstellar gas and dust. Such clouds are called nebulae, Latin for clouds. So the idea became known as the Nebular Hypothesis. As already noted, this collapse raises the temperature of the cloud at its center until thermonuclear fusion occurs. But there's another important phenomenon involved. So far, parts of the cloud that had no sideways motion fell straight to the center. All other parts slide into orbit as the cloud continues to contract. The cloud's rotation speed is greatly amplified, just as ice skaters spin faster when they pull in their arms. The rapid rotation sweeps all remaining debris into a spinning, flattened disk around the newly created star. Within this disk, Laplace suggested, planets would eventually form, all in the same flattened plane, orbiting their star all in the same direction, an elegant model for how the solar system came to be what we know it to be today. The Nebular Hypothesis accounts for many features of our solar system and implies that the formation of planetary systems should be common, which suggests, in turn, that Earth may not be the only planet in the galaxy that supports life. Today's spacecraft and telescopes have detected protoplanetary disks around many other newly forming stars. And we now know that planets are so common in the Milky Way that they likely outnumber the hundreds of billions of stars themselves.
An exchange that may not have taken place. When Laplace presented his tome on celestial mechanics to Napoleon, the emperor is supposed to have said, "You have written this huge book on the system of the world without once mentioning the author of the universe." Laplace replied, "Sire, I had no need of that hypothesis."
The Frost Line. Once the sun turned on fusion reactions and started to shine, the rest of the solar system began to take shape. But when we look around the neighborhood today, we see a major difference between the planets. Close to the sun, we find the rocky worlds, Mercury, Venus, Earth, and Mars, the so-called terrestrial planets. Farther out, we find the gas giants, Jupiter and Saturn, and the ice giants, Uranus and Neptune, a family of four collectively called the Jovian planets. How did two distinct categories of planets come to dominate our solar system? The nebula that eventually became our solar system was composed of two kinds of materials, volatiles and non-volatiles. Volatiles are elements like nitrogen and molecules of water that easily vaporize when heated. Non-volatiles are materials like sand grains that remain solid at those same temperatures. While the sun cranks up its fusion reactions, two things happen. First, the sun starts to radiate energy into space, raising the temperature of materials close to it. Second, the solar wind particles cast into space from the sun's surface intensifies dramatically. The heat turns any volatile materials into gas, and the solar wind sweeps these gases from the inner solar system. So the only materials left for making planets are things like mineral grains that have not vaporized. Planets built from this winnowed selection of material are small and rocky. Those farther away from the sun in the outer solar system are large and composed primarily of volatiles. The dividing line between non-volatile rocky planets and volatile Jovian planets occurs at the frost line, a distance from the sun where the temperature has dropped too low to vaporize volatile materials in the planetary disk. So simple physics explains some of the salient features of star systems. Or does it? As we shall soon see, the subsequent stages in the evolution of the universe quickly become both complex and curious. Cosmic billiards. We once presumed planet formation was simple, and that the solar system itself was surely representative of star systems across the galaxy. We figured that inside the frost line, mineral grains and other solids would stick together to form house-size objects called planetesimals, that in turn would combine under the influence of gravity to form Mars-size protoplanets. These would then sweep up the remaining debris in the disk and grow to their present size. Farther out, we figured, the Jovian planets must have formed in ways similar to how the Sun formed from an interstellar cloud. Unfortunately, that simplicity was not to last. By the early 21st century, we finally figured out how to make detailed and accurate computer models of evolving protoplanetary disks. And it was anything but simple. The inner solar system may have been populated by up to 30 planet-sized objects whose gravitational interplay resembles cosmic billiards. Some of those early objects collided with one another, shattering into bits. Some were incorporated into other bodies. Others plunged into the sun. Still others were entirely ejected from the solar system on a journey to becoming the most interesting objects in our story, rogue planets. So the eight planets we know and love are just the lucky survivors, with stable, uncontested orbits. Although a planet kicked out of the solar system is no longer bound by the sun's gravity, it cannot escape the gravitational field that pervades the entire galaxy. Like the sun itself, the planet will orbit the galactic center, just as stars do. If every planetary system that has formed since the birth of the Milky Way contributed a few homeless planets to the mix, we are led to an extraordinary conclusion. Not only are there more planets than stars in the galaxy, but the majority of planets may also not be circling stars at all.
A tweet. Solar system has always been a kind of shooting gallery, or rather, a cosmic ballet, choreographed by the forces of gravity.
Planetary migration. While cosmic billiards played out in the inner solar system, the Jovian planets were caught up in a game of their own. We once presumed the formation of the solar system was smooth and stately. We were wrong. In fact, our current understanding has Jupiter caroming around the solar system, sculpting many of the unusual features we see today. Some have nicknamed the scenario we're about to describe as the Grand Tack, after a sailing maneuver called tacking, which allows a boat to move into the wind by continually changing direction in a zigzag pattern. Here it goes. Jupiter formed just outside of the frost line over the course of a few million years. Its sustained interaction with the protoplanetary disk sent it spiraling slowly in toward the sun. During Jupiter's migration, Saturn grew to roughly its present size and began its own inward migration. Smaller than Jupiter, Saturn moves more quickly and got close enough to Jupiter to exert a significant gravitational force. The gravitational interaction between the two planets and the protoplanetary disk caused both to turn around and start migrating outward. By this time, Uranus and Neptune formed, and the gravitational interaction among outer planets moved them to their present orbits. Strange as it may seem, this complicated choreography among the outer planets actually explains many properties of the inner ones, too, fine-tuning our understanding of how the universe got to be the way it is. Jupiter plowing through the protoplanetary disk was like a bowling ball going through 10 pins. Some material in the disk was pushed into the sun, while other material was ejected from the solar system. Thus, Mars and the asteroid belt are much less massive than you would expect them to be. Any protoplanets that might have grown bigger than Earth would have suffered the same fate. Thus, Earth is the largest possible rocky planet in our solar system. Finally, the reshuffling of the four Jovian planets at the end of the planetary maneuvering sent a rain of icy comets and debris in toward the terrestrial planets, creating what is called the period of late heavy bombardment. Some evidence shows this may be the source of all water in Earth's oceans.
The plight of Pluto. In the solar system, Pluto has never not been odd. It's a small planet, yet found where ice giants should be. And it travels on an eccentric orbit, embarrassingly tilted relative to the rest of the planets. Pluto is, in fact, the first Kuiper Belt object discovered. Not the end of the beginning, but the beginning of the end. Pluto was considered a planet until 2006, when a controversial decision officially demoted it to a dwarf planet. The International Astronomical Union, IAU, laid out three criteria of planetary status. 1. The object orbits around the Sun. 2. The object is round. 3. The object clears its orbit. Pluto fulfills the first two criteria for planethood, but fails the third. It's a round object that orbits the Sun, but it's not massive enough to have gravitationally dominated its orbit, instead sharing the space with other small icy objects with similar orbital features, collectively known as Plutinos. A few astrophysicists, many planetary scientists, and anyone who learned that Pluto is a planet in elementary school remain critical of the IAU planet definition. It includes criteria for where you might find an object rather than for what the object is, which, among other problems, confounds efforts to establish planethood for rogue planets that wander interstellar space. Also, Pluto, with its active geology, its thin but complex atmosphere, and a possible subsurface ocean of liquid water, might well turn out to be like Europa and Enceladus, a home for extraterrestrial life. A tweet. Hashtag PlutoFacts. Earth's moon is 5 times more massive than Pluto. Get over it.
The outer reaches. So, there's the current story of our well-known 8-planet solar system. What's beyond, and how did it get to be that way? On New Year's Day 2019, the New Horizons spacecraft flew by an object in the Kuiper Belt, the realm of small icy bodies in our solar system far outside the orbits of the familiar planets. The object is formally designated 2014 MU69, with the name Arakov, the Powhatan word for sky. It's one of millions of such objects orbiting the Sun in a puffy disk that extends out beyond the orbit of our farthest planet, Neptune. Most Kuiper Belt objects, KBOs, are composed of frozen volatiles like water, ammonia, and methane. These materials were too distant to be affected by all the shenanigans that went on near the Sun, and so remain a repository of the earliest stages of the solar system, like piles of debris left on a construction site after a building is finished. In 2003, a planet-sized object was discovered among the rubble in the Kuiper Belt. Only slightly smaller than Pluto, this object was eventually named Eris. More than a dozen planetary objects like this have been discovered, and there may be many more. Other KBOs bear names like Haumea and Makemake, often an indication that they were discovered using telescope assets on Mauna Kea, on the Big Island of Hawaii. One particularly interesting hypothesis, based on irregularities in the orbits of some KBOs, is that there may be a body out there, 10 times the size of Earth, tugging on them. And beyond the Kuiper Belt lies a distant, yet-to-be-explored region surrounding the solar system on all sides, known as the Oort Cloud, also composed of icy objects. The cozy, comfortable world of the familiar solar system, planets, moons, and asteroids, is actually a tiny part of the whole. The solar system extends far beyond the limits that, until recently, were thought to bound it.
Naming Kuiper Belt objects. By convention, Kuiper Belt objects are named for mythological figures associated with creation. But they often acquire nicknames before the official naming process plays out. Eris, for example, is named for the Greek goddess of discord, but was nicknamed Xena after the fictional warrior princess on a popular TV show. Makemake, discovered around Easter time, was nicknamed Easter Bunny before it was officially named for the chief god in the pantheon of the Easter Islanders.
Chapter 4. How old is the universe? Surprise number 1. Cosmic microwave background. Surprise number 2. The message in the microwaves. Surprise number 3. The inflationary universe. Surprise number 4. Temperature differences in the CMB. The astronomical distance ladder. Surprise number 5. Dark energy. The tension. Surprise number 6. Dark matter. Formations of the universe. 4. Right now, you read these words not as they are now, but as they were a couple of nanoseconds ago. That's how long it took light to travel from the page to your eye. In the same way, light from the sun takes about 8 minutes to travel from the solar surface to Earth. For all you know, the sun could have exploded 5 minutes ago, but you'll have to wait another 3 minutes to find out. If we want to know how old the universe is, then we need to detect light that was emitted by the farthest object we can see. The age of the universe is estimated to be either 12.5 or 13.8 billion years old, though most scientists agree on 13.8. We'll discuss the reason for the difference shortly. This means that the oldest light we detect today was emitted 13.8 billion years ago. If the universe was static or stationary, we would say the observable universe is a sphere extending 13.8 billion light years from the center. But we don't live in a static universe. We live in one that's expanding. This means that while light emitted from a distant galaxy makes its way toward Earth, that galaxy is also moving farther away from us. If we define the observable universe as all the objects we've ever seen or ever can see, then we're talking about a sphere centered on us that extends about 45 billion light years in every direction. But maybe the universe extends beyond what we can observe, which leads directly to the question, what fraction of the total universe is spanned by the observable universe? If, as some theorists suggest, the observable universe is a small part of the whole thing, then the actual edge, if there is such a thing, remains forever out of reach. Who knows what lurks beyond our cosmic horizon, let alone how old it is? Even what lurks within it puzzles us. We are still being surprised by what we discover. Each surprise adds information and more questions. Surprise number 1. Cosmic microwave background. Anything with a temperature above absolute zero radiates electromagnetic waves into its environment. The variety of waves emitted depends on how hot the object is. The sun, with a surface temperature of about 5,000 degrees Celsius, peaks in the visible part of the spectrum. Ordinary objects on Earth's surface, including your body, peak in the infrared, wavelengths longer than visible light. Objects at much lower temperatures peak at even longer wavelengths. The cosmic microwave background hails from when the universe was young. You experienced this progression of radiative energy the last time you sat around a campfire. When the fire was roaring, the coals at the center may have appeared white hot, emitting light at all visible wavelengths. As the fire died down, the coals turned red, still emitting visible light, but light that had, on average, shifted toward the long wavelength, or red part of the spectrum. The next morning, the coals no longer glowed, but you could still feel heat if you put a hand over them. The faded but still warm coals were radiating primarily in the infrared. The universe is like those coals in your campfire. It started out hot and dense and has been expanding and cooling for billions of years. By analyzing the radiation it emits, we can trace its history and thereby measure the age and also the size of the universe. In 1964, Arno Penzias and Robert Wilson, two physicists at the Bell Telephone Laboratories in New Jersey, conducted a simultaneously practical yet dull experiment when they accidentally unlocked a secret message from the universe. Satellite communication was new at the time, and the systems used microwaves to send signals. Penzias and Wilson were using an old microwave receiver to scan the skies and see what kinds of random microwave signals might be out there, because that radiation might well interfere with the satellites themselves. To their consternation, they found that wherever they pointed the receiver, they detected a faint microwave signal manifesting as a hiss in their earphones. In situations like this, experimenters presume the problem to be a fault of their apparatus, so Penzias and Wilson spent a lot of time troubleshooting. They did find that a group of pigeons had nested in the receiver, depositing, as the physicists delicately put it, a white dielectric substance on its surface. But even after they shooed away the pigeons and cleaned up their poo, the microwave hiss persisted. Eventually, Penzias and Wilson made contact with physicists at nearby Princeton University, who deduced that the hiss wasn't an artifact of their detector. Instead, the signal emanates from deep space, which is why they detected the hiss in every direction they turned their receiver. The physicists pointed out that the cooling of a very hot universe after billions of years would by now be giving off microwave radiation. Like the campfire coals, the universe was radiating at a wavelength appropriate to its temperature. This surprise discovery told us that we can see backward in time to events a few 100,000 years after the Big Bang. In fact, subsequent satellite measurements confirmed this picture, and the discovery of the so-called cosmic microwave background, hereinafter abbreviated as CMB, provides critical evidence in support of the Big Bang theory. For their work, Penzias and Wilson received the Nobel Prize in 1978.
What is absolute zero? The temperature and the age of the universe go hand in hand. But to talk about temperature, we need a baseline. Because there's no such thing as cold, only the absence of heat, you can have as much heat as you can muster. But as you take it away, you reach a cold limit. -459.67 degrees Fahrenheit, -237.15 degrees Celsius.